Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello and welcome to episode 395 of the Filmmakers Podcast. This is a podcast where we talk
filmmaking.
From indie film to TV to documentary to...
Is that low-end TV or is it high-end TV?
To TV, including high-end TV, and...
everything in between.
How to get them made, how to make them, and how to try not to...
royally F them up.
As well as the intro, in our very, very humble opinion. Hello, everybody. How are you doing? Thank you for listening. I'm Giles Alderson. I am a director. I'm also a writer, and I am also a bit of a producer. And you are?
Dom Lenoir.
Also a...
So, how do I say it so it sounds fresh when you've already said, like, all three of the roles?
Try it.
Yeah.
Go
all
on,
right. I'm a director, I'm a writer, and a producer. There we go.
That sounds so fresh.
Yeah.
On today's show, we have the legendary producer, Kelly McCormick. She not only has produced some incredible films, whose credits include Atomic Blonde, Deadpool 2, Fast and Furious, Hobbs and Shaw, Violent Night, and The Fall Guy, which is what we're here to talk about. The brand new David Leitch movie starring Ryan Gosling.
Ryan's
and
the G.
Emily Blunt.
Let's not forget Aaron Taylor Johnson.
Woohoo!
And Hannah Waddingham.
The Fall Guy is out in cinemas this Thursday. 3rd of May? Is that Thursday?
Yeah. Why not? Might be the 2nd, might be the 3rd.
Yeah. Why not?
You've seen the posters, just get down to the cinema and book your ticket and go and watch it.
Yeah, so what do you talk about with Kelly? Because I again was filming and couldn't make it. She's very annoying recently because you've sat down with some amazing guests.
I have.
Dom Lenoir, Mr. Dom Lenoir. What will our audience learn from today's masterclass?
We talked about how to shoot real stunts cost-effectively, cross-cutting action to raise the stakes and limit street filming in a busy city, the importance of supporting cast and their character arcs, finding the balance between rom-com, thriller and drama, tonally, shooting in Australia for tax credits and tone, and lastly, casting Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt and working out that incredible chemistry.
Well, if you weren't excited before this podcast started, I imagine you're very excited now. This is super stuff. This is just wonderful and very honest. Interview as well between the two of you. You got on like a house on fire as well.
Yes, a house on fire.
You also dropped in your own movie that you directed and produced called Winter Ridge. So good for you, which also starred Hannah Waddingham.
Yep.
Which all our listeners know about now, because if you haven't watched it and you listen to this podcast, then woe betide you.
Exactly.
You won't be on our Christmas quiz list of winners.
That's true.
No.
I mean, look, this film really surprised me in a very good way, because I saw the trailers and I thought this is going to be a good movie. I'm going to enjoy this. And then I went in and I was like, wow, this is like really, really good. It was like the action. I mean, I already said it in the interview, like the last time I had this much fun was at Top Gun Maverick. And it's because the pacing was so good in this. Like, you know, it was just bam, 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 bam. Everything felt like incredibly tightly moved. And yet, you had these very, very, very strong chemistry between, you know, all of the characters, all the supports, this really captivating romance between Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. And it just all sort of wound together in this, like, really funny, really outrageous, and yet never too silly extravaganza. So... well, you know, definitely going to be in my top three for the year, like, without a doubt. And has to be seen in the cinema. No excuses.
Wow, wow, wow. Yeah, there is no excuses, especially these days. I think it's a perfect time to get out, go see something, then scuttle back to our little caves that we've already created.
Giles lives in an actual cave.
I've been in many caves.
You actually did a documentary on a cave, yeah?
I did a whole documentary on being in the most, most remote caves in the world. And yes, I do live in one of them now. I've seen artwork that only like a handful of people have seen that was drawn thousands of years ago. It's pretty impressive. Mm. But anyway, enough about me. let's talk about David Leitch, who is the director of The Fall Guy. He's obviously, his directorial debut was John Wick, the action film which he directed with Chad Stahelski, though only Stahelski was credited for that. And he also directed the thriller film Atomic Blonde, which starred Charlize Theron, and Deadpool 2. And he also directed Hobbs and Shaw, which was a spin-off of the Fast and Furious franchise. Recently, Bullet Train, which starred Brad Pitt, and now The Fall Guy. He's just an incredible director. And David and Kelly are a couple in real life.
They're one of those like powerhouse couples that just seem to,
yeah,
you know, just great attitudes and great work.
And Kelly McCormick is a powerhouse, full of energy, which you will hear very, very soon. And see, because this was a filmed interview as well, so we will be putting this on our YouTube. If you haven't subscribed yet, please do. If we get over a certain amount of subscribers, then pennies do come back to the podcast.
And Giles might be able to live outside of his cave.
One day. Until that amazing moment when I do crawl out, shall we play the trailer for The Fall Guy and then dive into Dom's in chat with Kelly? And then on the other side, me and Dom will talk about action filmmaking, because both me and Dom have been doing that recently. Sound good?
Sounds good.
Right, cool. Thank you so much, by the way, for listening to last week's episode with Zack Snyder. If you haven't listened to that one yet, you're mad. Millions of you have, not millions.
Don't forget Ed Skrein and Sophia Botella.
Yeah, who join Zack Snyder on that episode. So, listen to that one after you've listened to this one. So here is Dom's chat with Kelly McCormick. See you on the other side.
This film has everything.
Everything?
Do you want to make out or?
Nope. Oh, yes.
This does not seem safe!
We're getting tangled in exposition.
Minerals.
Gold. What's an ice crime?
Are you saying ice cream or ice crime?
Ice crime.
Okay, it's just with your accent, it's hard. I'm not reporting an ice cream.
Yes, no, I get that.
Okay.
You're like sexy bacon.
What is this?
You know?
You need carbs!
What are you doing?
Just chilling down.
Have you been crying to Taylor Swift?
Doesn't everyone?
Filmmakers Podcast.
Hi, Dom. You got your winter boots on today.
I have, yes. It's sort of English spring, so it's incredibly cold.
It's a bit chilly.
It is a bit chilly.
Yeah.
How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm very well, yeah. I had a nice escape to the seaside over the weekend.
Oh, did you?
Very refreshed.
Was it cold?
It was very cold. We went in the sea and it was freezing.
Oh, my God.
But more importantly, how are you feeling about the release? I mean, I'm just going to preface this. This is the most enjoyable time I've had at cinema since Top Gun Maverick 2.
Wow.
So
thank you.
It was a big experience for me, and
wow.
I really enjoyed the film.
Thank you so much. Yeah. I'm really proud of it. I mean, I'm proud of most of our movies, all of our movies, I'd say. But this one feels really special. Yeah.
I think it is. Yeah. I mean, one of the things that really impressed me is the tone, because it sort of goes into rom-com. It goes into a really compelling, well-edited sort of action piece.
Yeah.
And then you've got the kind of Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. Their performances really ground it, and they make it incredibly charming and likable. So let's talk about how this sort of started, what the genesis of the project was, and how you sort of got involved.
So, I mean, first of all, thank you for that. And I think David does make these kind of tonal combinations in such a cool way. And having the love story at the center of this one as the spine gave him another sort of like dimension to add to sort of his storytelling, which was really exciting. We got the title from our producing partner, Guyman Cassidy. So it had been around for a while. I think it was at Warner Brothers for some time. And
Okay. There
had been rumblings that other people were attached. I had an eye on it because I thought it could be a really great piece for David to be able to really direct from a super authentic spot and also be a bit of a legacy piece for him because, you know, sort of like he did come from sort of stunt origins and things like that. So kind of an exciting way to kind of continue his story as a film, as a storyteller, the story behind the story.
Yeah, because there is a sort of autobiographical, I'm sure there was tons that he was able to sort of bring into the conversation that, you know, from his background. I mean, it feels very authentic from a stunt position as well as from the rest of the narrative.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, he, you know, he says that it's, you know, when you take on telling a story as a director, you have to sort of make believe all these different things about the story that you're telling and the backstory that you're telling and the, you know, how, why you're choosing the setting that you are and all these different things. When it comes to telling a story about a stunt performer, he's like, I have all that. So I'm coming from this place where it's like really sort of, I get to use all the sort of fodder and knowledge that I've learned from 20 years of being a stunt performer.
And I suppose all those details are what make it feel real and sort of lived in.
I think so. I also think, you know, we had a really interesting experience on this one where we sort of knew the story we wanted to tell. And we had these pillars of production, we call it, which are both like, you know, sort of set pieces, action set pieces, as well as like, you know, requirements for like turns of the actor or the character, I should say, at any given time. But then otherwise, it was kind of this free flowing, like sort of wild sort of ride. And I think that you feel that in the sort of in excitement of the story and the frenetic kind of fun that's kind of going on. And yet you feel safe, too. And I think that that was just kind of a product of like how we were making the film a little bit, which is kind of how it does feel when you're making a movie.
Yeah.
You know, that it's like you're tumbling down this hill and like there's probably a couple of things to hold on to at any given time. But like you're just kind of like until it's over.
But actually, I mean, I suppose it's sort of credit to you and David and your experience in filmmaking. But I was actually felt that it was incredibly well structured in terms of like when characters sort of moved into certain, you know, narrative arcs, it all felt incredibly at the right time. It all felt very well paced. It didn't feel like there's any wild jumps between anything. So I think you balanced that kind of frenetic energy with the storytelling sort of very
Thank you. Yeah, those are what I would call the pillars of production. So yes. It's, you know, those moments that we knew we were aiming toward. And what was beautiful is all of us were making the same movie. Like that, I always believe in that. And I think that's one of the things you have to sort of like have signed on to make the same film. And then you can be a little free within, but like you all know that those are the things you have to hit along the way, you know, almost like you know, sticking a landing after a pole vault or something.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah.
Like, it's like those moments have got to be really thought through and planned. And then you can play within. And I think that freedom between the pillars is what allows it to feel really alive.
So in terms of the script, when you received the script or when you sort of both signed on and you started sort of developing it, you know, as a sort of David Leitch and your collaboration, what were some of the notes and the changes that you implemented in, you know, at the sort of script level and the development level?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we started, it was totally unencumbered when we started. So we put together this pitch, which was incredibly noir. It was dark. Okay. It was set in LA. It was like brooding, more kind of nice guys. It had a little bit of wit in our minds, but it was like really sort of like, you know, noir. And then we sold it as that to Universal. And then, I don't know, as we started writing, it was just like, we just found that it could be so much more fun and so much more connectable. And like, you know, how do we make it for everybody? And, you know, when we make films, we think a lot about our audience and how can we just entertain them and sort of introduce them to this world story behind the story of like how we make movies, you know, and sort of like help them have the best experience ever. And then it just kind of culminated into a lot more fun. One of the interesting things was Jody Moreno's character was originally a makeup artist.
Okay.
We had this idea that she was a bit older, maybe a sort of like older sister figure. And, you know, there is an intimacy between makeup artist and stunt performer or their actor. And maybe it's the same woman who was with both Aaron and, you know, Taylor Johnson's character and Ryan's character. And she became kind of pivotal in that. And we were going to put these like disguises on him and she was going to be connected in that way. And then we just kind of were like, you know what, like, is there more that, you know, not to disparage anything about like the talents of a makeup artist or anything, but would it put Jodie Moreno in a more complicated situation if she was directing for the first time? And if that, you know, sort of the weight of her dream on her shoulders would put her in a place where her stakes were really high when this guy shows up, that she's like the last thing she wants to have happen, you know?
Yeah.
And it's
a huge like curveball, isn't it? When you're, you know, there's so much pressure as a director.
Especially for the first time.
And it's kind of
a big movie for the first time.
Yeah.
And like, you know,
it's massive. It's like you couldn't do a bigger movie as your first feature, could you?
Yeah, no, I don't think so. And then she then also has like a story of her own in a sense where like this movie that she's making is like, you know, she's not just servicing like a makeup artist, kind of like taking care of him and Aaron. She's like in charge and has to get this thing done. And we just felt like those stakes were really exciting for her. And also like a commentary on trying to give, you know, women more opportunities.
Yeah.
And that really stuck. And then Emily came in. And what was interesting is like, you know, when you're maybe ghosted and when you're sort of, you know, in this spot, you could play it in a really cold way that's like angry and a bit, you know, sort of like flustered in this experience and, you know, sort of nervous about the decisions that she's making. And instead, Emily's choice was to bring all this warmth and all this like excitement and all this love for her movie and, you know, and vulnerability to being ready to maybe accept the love of her life back into her life.
Yeah. I mean, she was such a good casting for it, and you know, I think it's one of her best performances. And I think people often they sort of look at like serious drama and tears, and they think that's the hardest thing to do well. But I think actually to manage being really funny, really charming, a little bit silly, but completely grounded is really tough.
It is really tough.
You're kind of carrying a Hollywood movie, but you're also really doing a character piece because this is a, you know, very much a character piece.
Yeah.
So was she always the sort of the initial choice?
She was our dream choice, and we actually went to her right after we had converted the part to the to the director, and it was very rough, and I was like, oh dear. Her agent Chris Andrews read it, and he's like, I'm gonna give it to her, and I was like, you are? Oh my god. Like, because it really needed a lot of like attention.
Yeah.
And she saw through it and she saw the potential, and I think she also really was really excited to work with Ryan and David.
Yeah.
And so then she jumped in and really tailored the character, and then, you know, we all sort of tailored then Ryan's character too, because we had to leave space for this true romance that became the spine of the movie, even though the film is called The Fall Guy. But it allowed for another sort of meaning to the Fall Guy. He's like super falling in love, which is like, you know, part of the fun of it.
They're such an iconic sort of duo as well. So did you say that Ryan was attached before Emily? Is that right?
Yeah, Ryan was attached upon sort of like pitch. We went straight to him even before we sold it. He attached, which we felt really lucky about. He was our only choice. We would have had to throw it out.
Was it a simple sort of process? Or I mean, was it you ring the agent, they like the script, they've obviously heard of you as a sort of a team?
It was, we rang the agent and there were three pages. And it was like, what? You know, and Ryan was like, I'm in, let's do this. And we made this like reel, like a sizzle reel to sell it off of and he like gave an interview, and we all gave interviews, and it, you know, Drew Pierce, our writer, sort of does the through line of like the beats of the movie. And then it's got a bunch of reference, like, you know, footage, like kind of cut into it. And then people wanted it.
That's really interesting, because I always assumed that the sort of the sizzle reel was something, because, you know, filmmakers were often told to do a sizzle reel to sort of sell the pitch. I always thought that people in your sort of position wouldn't necessarily have to, or maybe you chose to because you had such a clear sort of idea of what it was. But it's a fascinating that was sort of part of the pitching process.
We've done a few of them. They help really well, like, if you're going to try to sell just a pitch, you know, in part because then it's like fewer conversations, like, you know, especially these times where it's usually Zoom and you're like trying to get everybody on a Zoom, and especially with like people like as busy as David and Ryan, you know. And so if you just can get everybody like, you know, in this sort of, I don't know, it was like 3 minutes, share it to the everybody who might, you know, want to buy it and support us.
Yeah.
And then it just kind of speeds up the process a little bit. Like,
Yeah.
They know more what they're getting.
Yeah,
we
yeah.
don't have to be in front of a million different, you know, sort of meetings. And it's worked really well for us in the past.
It's pretty good.
You can also allow for the tone to slip in really easily with the references and songs and things, you know. And of course, it changed 180 degrees since then. But
yeah,
I think they're happy.
Yeah, no, I mean, they should be. They should be happy. So let's talk about the rest of the cast. How do those sort of decisions come on board?
Hannah Waddingham was my pick for Gail. I think she was sort of this perfect sort of like combination of like the biggest boss in the world. And then just she does exude this warmth at the same time.
Yeah.
Funny story. She came on set and she had her platinum blonde hair and we were going to put her in these power suits. And that's what we kind of expected.
Yeah.
But then, you know, the movie is kind of like just modern and fresh, and there's a tingle to it in a certain way. And we were already establishing that by the time she came in for her role.
Yeah.
And none of that kind of made sense. And she was only there for a couple of days before she had to start shooting because Ted Lasso was long.
It's more encompassing,
We almost lost her over it because it was like too close, really. And she came in and it was just like, oh, none of this feels quite right. And she follows me around for the 2 days that she has. And next thing you know, she's in a wig that looks a lot like my hair.
Right,
and in a layered look that's like kind of what I wear on set. And I was like, I don't know if I like this life art imitating my life in this way, because we know who she is in the movie.
Yeah.
But I think, again, like you fall for the idea, especially because they both speak British English, that like she really is out to help Jodie. She really is out to like, you know, sort of, you know, save this movie. And then this other stuff happens. It's not very good, but like, this is more important. And so she's going to make it happen. I thought it was a great through line for the, for the villain. And I think she played it perfectly because I think she's really tucked in for so long, you know?
She was the villain in my film, like a few years ago.
And
played not a completely different character, but played someone that was very warm and understanding and then sort of becomes a villain. She's definitely one of the best people, you know, to work with. She's got such a great attitude.
She really does. She's amazing. Yeah. We loved working with her. We wanted her to speak American English at one point, which she can.
Yeah.
But there was so much improvising on our set that's really hard to do.
Yeah,
like you have to really know, you know, and having just come from Ted Lasso and like, you know, getting into American English.
It's a Hollywood film. It's everything so stunt orientated. How do you improvise?
Yeah. Well, the stunts don't improvise.
No. We'll set the car this way.
But the scenes within, there was a lot of freedom. I think you can feel it. I think that's why really the romance in specific, but also all of the relationships feel really organic and like modern and real because there was a lot of freedom. And they knew their character. They knew where we were heading. Everybody was making the same movie. And so and David creates a very safe environment. So you can just kind of like flow and sort of like find whatever feels most right in the moments. And she hadn't improv for a long time, and she's a great improver. And then she came to our set and she was like, oh dear, yes, I'm improving. And like she had to recalibrate, and then it was just like she was off to the race. She's so amazing. Winston Duke was our, you know, pick for stunt coordinator of our movie. He is incredible. I mean, I think he's doing a lot of things. I mean, first, he's representative of like, let's get more heads of departments, you know, of diversity in the mix because he has the strength of character and he does feel like this very safe guiding force for Colt in a lot of different moments. And then also we put the through line in where he has all of these film references. He's a true cinemaphile and film lover. And we wanted to make sure that flowed in, that gave them something to connect on throughout the film. And I think it's really fun. Plus, he's actually really good at action. He's a huge man.
Yeah.
And he is so graceful. And so he should have been like a football player, I think. He has this athleticism and this size, and it's just beautiful to watch him.
But warmth and grounding as well. Like he really does sort of connect the characters, and all the supporting characters like really feel deliberately placed, and they work, you know, towards the central story, and they help the other characters sort of develop.
He's so good. He has one of my favorite lines, which is like when he's got the tomahawk.
Oh yeah,
and it's like, is this rubber? It's so funny, actually. Like you don't catch it maybe the first time around, but like it's just a very, very funny line.
Well, because so many of the lines have meaning I think if you've got nothing to do with film, it's just funny. But if you're in film, it's doubly funny because there's so many of these moments that do happen on set, and you know, the crazy sort of things that people never realize about, you know, rubber props, all these kinds of things.
Yeah, we tried to be really that was a real conversation with the studio, like, how do you make it such that it's not insider baseball? You know, that's such a thing when you're doing a film within a film about a film. And yet, how do you create a world that these people are walking into? You know, I think it has a lot to do with Colt. I think Colt as this like perfect underdog hero, which it didn't really dawn on us that a stunt performer is the perfect underdog hero, where, you know, he literally or she risks it all when they get to set. They may even be risking their lives, and their job is not to be seen at all. Like, literally tuck your head so that you look like this other person, you know? Yeah. And from there, and also where we put him, right, which is like a comeback, like with his accident at the beginning of the film, he then has this beautiful sort of arc to hero that is punctuated with the action, and the action can be about stunts, right, but also are related to sort of his arc as a character. And then also he's just so warm, and Ryan is, and charismatic and so connectable that like you walk into this world with him and you're like there with him. And so you can fall for these things that like are stranger than truth, you know, of like an alien with his legs being seen and like any number of other things, you know, and you're just like in it. And I think you're just buying how original and weird actually a set is.
It is, you know? It's, you know, so many bonkers things that sort of happen as well. I love the moment when the first AD is like running to set.
Traveling.
Yeah, traveling, yeah. Just like these little words that are like, so quirky and surreal, but everyone's obviously in the pressure of the film shoot, so never really thinks about it at the time.
Yeah.
But when you sort of look at it from the outside, it's brilliant, but it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Of the sort of stuff going on.
Speaking of moving on, like, you know, he's so good, by the way.
Yeah. Sort of the sarcasm always like part of some kind of AD that's you know, good at sort of keeping things light, but obviously has that pressure to sort of, you know, keep things moving.
Totally, yeah.
So let's talk about Aaron as well, because I mean, he's a classic sort of
He's so good. I mean, we were so lucky that he was available. We had so much fun with him on Bullet Train.
Yeah.
And have been trying to find, I mean, that was in our next movie, but anything we can do with Aaron, it's like, how can we? And it's not a huge role, but it's an super important one, right? It's like he's haunting the whole movie. He's the motivating factor of it all happening. And then to me, he's supposed to be representing toxic celebrity at its highest. And he brings it to most toxic. He brings it to 11. And yet you still feel for him at various moments, you know what I mean? Yeah. Because that's how good Aaron Taylor Johnson is. I think that torture sequence is one of the most brilliant sort of moments in the movie. I mean, because there's this beautiful thing that's happening where there's a familiarity that happens instantly, to the point where even, you know, Colt is like, doesn't really believe he's in that much trouble until like that very turn at the end. And they're kind of reminiscing and, you know, making clear how much time, how close they really are, how close that bond really is in this very sort of like what will become super dangerous moment, you know? Yes. It was that was a tricky one to balance. Yeah. It's like because they did get sillier. And they did get more serious. And it's like, you know, in different takes. So it's like, which ones sort of like were just the right flow where you could have a little fun, know that they were familiar, you know, Colt not trust that he's necessarily all the way going to go to something really, really bad. And then have real danger by the end of it.
Yeah.
This is really special. And I think the two of them had to be the actors that they are to really grab that scene the way it's
I think the it could have gone lighter and cheesier at a lot of moments in the film. And I feel like had it gone further, that's the kind of thing that ruins films. And like, you have to hit it so carefully, like making it fun, but never making it so silly where people don't believe it. And I think those kind of nuances really did that. I mean, I thought what was really interesting about Aaron's performance was there is this kind of narcissism. And it sort of, you show the vulnerability, I guess, of someone that really cares about how they're viewed and don't realize that they're the bad guy because their image is like this all-encompassing kind of thing. And I think that really works to sort of ground him. And I thought that was a sort of great collaboration.
I think that's true. Yeah. I think that's true.
So In terms of like the budget and how to sort of put together the actual film, once you've got cast attached, I suppose you know the sort of rough idea of what the numbers are going to be. How did those sort of decisions come about as a producer in terms of where you're going to shoot, exactly how big the action and the stunts can be? I mean, it feels like you didn't hold anything back. But like, how did those sort of conversations with Universal and making sure that it sort of worked on paper, you know, versus box office and those kinds of questions?
Yeah, I mean, it's an amount, right?
Yeah.
I've kind of given this budget and you are looking at, you know, how to put the most on the screen. Mm. And, you know, there are, as you know, there's places where there are incentives.
Tax incentives, yeah.
And you have to, you know, if you're really doing that at this size, you're really looking specifically at the tax incentivized locations. Mm. The movie actually at one point was going to be in Europe. And then we had to wait for Barbie. And thus it was winter in Europe. And what we wanted was a really warm, sexy, like, you know, cosmopolitan destination that also, you know, when you work in the film business, you live in LA, you never work in your hometown. You're always going someplace else.
Yeah.
So we wanted that for Colt Seavers really badly because it's really part of what happens on bigger movies, especially. And so then Australia ended up opening up and being, you know, Sydney ended up being the perfect destination for it for all those reasons. Like, it was summer there when it was winter in the Northern Hemisphere.
Wow, yeah.
It's a really cool town that is very infrequently used as a location shooting, as the location. A lot of people shoot there and only shoot stages for the whole time. Like Shang-Chi, like, was shot there. And also they had a really interesting COVID where they were really particularly like
locked down. Yeah.
And some films had left because of that. Just the restrictions were too difficult to kind of like navigate and negotiate. And so we wanted to kind of like go to Sydney and like wake it up, you know, and they accepted us with open arms and gave us these amazing locations and like destinations, literally, of like the Harbour Bridge and like the Sydney Opera House that were like, you know, haven't been shot like that since like, I think, A Mission like 10 years ago or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think it's, you know, we talk about the movie as a love letter of a lot of things. One of the love letters, I think, is to Sydney. And I hope that people see it as such, you know.
And the culture as well. I think the culture is like very funny.
Yeah.
You know, Australians do have a great sense of humor. There's something that just naturally works with comedy that sort of seems to fit into it so well.
We could kind of make fun of different things about being a fish out of water there.
Yeah.
And I totally agree. And their incentive is incredible. So back to your sort of like the conversation about the budget. So then that allowed us to do, you know, to actually, there were some challenges and opportunities. The garbage bin sequence is interwoven with the karaoke scene because you can't really grab huge stretches for action either because it locks down their travel patterns too much and they still have to function as a city, or because they really don't have a, I mean, if you know that town, it's not that big of a town, even though it's a huge town. You know what I mean? Like, so it's, it required us to only grab the moments and, you know, that we really wanted rather than the shoe leather of normal action sequences. And so we interwove it with the karaoke scene so that we could go back and forth and only capture like the bits that really worked for the action. But then it works so perfectly as an interweave because you want to know what's happening in both of these moments. And then the Phil Collins in there and the like spinning of the bit. It's just so, it became a huge opportunity that we definitely like took the most advantage of.
Yeah, I mean, that was a great choice because I remember thinking on those streets, like, that's like the height of Hollywood challenge, you know, trying to get those kind of sequences in public roads.
Yeah.
You know, like big things happening, like very destructive looking things.
Yeah.
And I suppose capturing those sort of moments, you know, is really important. You did an excellent job on that.
Thank you.
So just going back to the sort of the start of your career, because we're a filmmaking podcast and we like to sort of see how people got started out. What was your journey sort of into film and I suppose getting that big break? It'd be a really sort of useful
piece of
information.
So I wanted to be a documentarian and I sort of got a lot of opportunities very early on in my career to work in television documentaries. So like news type things like American Justice on A&E and those kinds of things. And it was really informative and really helpful. What I realized is that it's really hard to sell a participant into getting their 15 minutes of fame through really difficult stories in their lives. Yeah. And sometimes that backfires on you. And I didn't feel comfortable with it at some point pretty early on in my career. And so I tried to move into narrative. And I was in Chicago at the time. I moved to New York because LA didn't feel quite right for me. And I got a job as Frank Oz's assistant on the Stepford Wives. And it was a really complicated, long shoot. I think like the longest over budget, over schedule and wow. over budget of all of Paramount history.
Yeah.
And so I learned a lot.
Yeah.
I actually worked for Scott Rudin. He was the producer on that movie and he invited me to join his development department after that.
Amazing.
It was a, you know, tough environment, but it was also a graduate degree education and sort of, you know, filmmaking and development and packaging and, you know, finding material and what to look for in material and stuff like that. And it was a really, really important time in my career. Then I moved to LA and I got a job doing foreign sales financing. And I I was curating the slates that this group would sell to make like Place Beyond the Pines or Nightcrawler or, you know, lots of films like that. Manchester by the Sea. And I was there for six.
Love that film. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. I was there for 6 years.
Yeah.
And I was really honing my taste. Mm. At the same time, I was managing David and Chad.
Right.
I had picked them up from this job I had in at Circle of Confusion as a manager. And we were looking for movies for them to direct. And the script of John Wick came across my desk for our foreign sales company that I was working for.
Yeah.
Gave it to the guys, introduced them to Basil Iwanek. And that was probably the big moment because then they obviously ended up going to direct that. And then, you know, their careers got so big that I couldn't juggle both jobs. And so then I leapt over and became a producer for, and Atomic Blonde is really the connector. So
yes.
I was doing that at that foreign sales company and I attached David Leitch to direct it. And then that sort of became what ended up being the beginning.
And the rest is history.
Yeah. Sorry. It's a long story. I'm
no,
sure
no,
that
no, it's good.
Over,
you managed to succinctly fit it into like three or four minutes of our remaining time. So well done that. Again, a massive congratulations. Like, I think it's so hard to make a movie this fun that's this grounded. So best of luck with
thank
it.
Thank you. All your future thank you so much. It's really nice to talk to you today.
Yeah. Really nice to chat. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
Oh, Dom, that was brilliant. You and Kelly, on fire. What a chat.
Oh, thank you. Well done, Kelly.
If you enjoyed that, please tell your pals, pass this on. It's amazing to hear producers do incredibly well, but to see that trajectory as well, and that you can as well. Do the same thing and go out there and make your films. Action filmmaking, it's a beast, isn't it? It's something that people take for granted, I feel. I feel you've sort of just, you know, she talked about it there in detail. And I think a lot of people don't think that much of it. Or, you know, certainly when we're starting out as filmmakers, we go, oh, okay, and then we've got the action bit. They kind of put it in the same context as doing a drama scene or a little bit of a tussle or whatever. But it's not. To do action really well, it takes a lot of skill. And it takes a lot of time as well. You've got to prepare it. Mm. I always try and put action in all my films. I feel like I have. I always kind of put something. But I know when I do it, I make sure I've got more time in the schedule. Are you the same? Because I know you've done quite a bit of action as well.
Do I add more time in the schedule?
Mm.
Yes. I mean, there generally isn't more time in the schedule.
No,
that's
I know.
The way,
but,
isn't it?
Yeah, but we have to, don't we? Because otherwise we then miss the boat and we suddenly, oh, I want to get all these shots and I want these, you know, you need cutaways. You need it.
Yeah.
Otherwise it's just, you might miss the hit or the fall.
Yeah,
or the...
I think the main thing for me is like planning to know, making sure everyone is briefed ahead of the game. Like the one we did recently, you know, there was cars involved. There was a sort of a filming vehicle and then there was like our vehicle. And there was like the track. And there was two like cars that were sort of driving as well. One of them was like a sports car. It was very important that the DOP and the driving vehicle knew exactly where we were shooting, what that looked like well in advance, where the road curves, like how much distance we've got for each of the sections, you know, how to break it up into sort of manageable sections. That's a really important bit because, you know, there were two overtaking maneuvers that were supposed to happen in a row, but actually doing them one by one saved us infinite amounts of time rather than trying to coordinate, you know,
getting them all in one go. Because it is, it's very finickety, and you want to be safe. And you want to not blow out your insurance.
Yes, so true. Should you bring on stunt coordinators?
Yeah, I mean, it depends what you're doing. Like, for instance, when we did something in Scotland where one actor had to, it was basically like it was a non-serious fall onto a crash mat. And it was a very stylized sequence, you know, low angles, funky shots, et cetera, et cetera. So in that kind of situation, we had crash mats. We went through the action, you know, slowly and in advance. There wasn't any like harmful deck tiles. We did risk assessments. It was an acceptable, you know, a very acceptable risk. And the actor was happy, and everyone in production that was, you know, from the AD sort of team and everything was happy that it was like a very small, you know, half full, basically.
Right.
But there are other times when, you know, you are doing something where there really is a chance of danger, and you should very much not cut any corners. You should always have stunts there. Mm-hmm. You know, especially when you're doing sort of, you know, any kind of weapons, anything hard, even sometimes just having tables and chairs nearby or having to do anything at speed. You know, if the camera angle isn't being cheated to really help out the safety of things, then, you know, you really need to, you know, make those considerations. And you know, it is worthwhile. It's worthwhile as well because it'll save you time figuring out how to do something that isn't going to hurt your actor.
Yes.
You know, and figuring out how that works so that they can, you know, fall over safely, repeatably as well. Because, you know, if you just do it DIY, then they might fall over twice and then they're hurt.
That's it.
Yeah, I'm not doing anymore, and then camera hasn't got it, and then you've got a problem for many reasons.
Of course you have. So it's so important to be safe. I feel like it's one of the most important things. That's why I like a stunt coordinator. I'm very hands-on when it comes to the action myself. I know what I like. I know I'd like the camera. I know I'd like the actors to be, but other people do this as a job and they're better than me. So of course I want their opinion and say, hey, can you make this, you know, sing even more? And I love it when they're so specific with a head move or a how far away the actors need to be from each other so they definitely don't hit, or the stunt people, whoever it will be. That is so important. But it's safety, because if someone gets hurt when you're doing a stunt, everything stops. Whereas if you've prepared and practiced and made sure that it's before you've turned over, that everyone is set, everyone knows what they're doing. It's like a dance routine. You know, you don't get that good at dancing just by going, hey, let's just go at this and let's see what happens. This takes, you know, rehearsal and skill and practice and timing. And it's the same with stunts. It really is. And film is kind of about illusion, isn't it? Right. Well, practical stunts, they can be real and dangerous, but it's an illusion. It's where the camera is. The angle is we're selling the audience on this. So yeah, for me it's about safety. Like you said, if you're going to do it a load of times in a row, the actor's got to be able to do that.
I suppose when I was doing my early stuff, like early features and doing fantasy films and silly sort of silly action scenes with people with plastic axes and other such thing, I didn't ask anyone to do anything serious themselves that were like, you know, they were sort of middle-aged actors. I sort of jumped into the suit and did it myself. And you know, having taken an axe, a plastic axe to the head at speed, it's not a tremendously enjoyable experience that I would want to put anyone else through. And it did make, you know, it did make me realize, like, it is a, you know, you can really get hurt very easily. And it would also be very easy to sort of damage camera and other things. And it's not worth sort of, it's not worth skimping on the action types.
No, it's not. I was over in Ljubljana, in Bulgaria, the studio over there for Film Forge shooting.
Yes, that was very exciting.
Some action recently, yeah. And just having that amazing skilled team around me, you know, proper stunt performers, proper stunt team, people who'd worked on so many big stunts, including The Expendables and Rambo and London Has Fallen, and all the sets are still there as well. And we got to film on some of them. And you're, you know, essentially I'm throwing a dummy off the roof. And a dummy. And it's kind of something I've always wanted to do, is do the shot where you're throwing a body off the roof, but just never able to do it. So I actually did throw a dummy off the roof. And everyone's got the dummy, you know, the dummy looked like a dummy. But when you do it in a certain camera angle and you throw it off and the wig's in the right way and the clothes, it looks real. It looked at the time everyone's laughing, silly or whatever. But actually, the shot's great. It's there in there. And I love all that. And cheating as well. The amount of cheating we did, we had to have someone stood very high up on a ledge, you know, very high, looking down. You know, it's very dangerous. And we just cheated it to be a totally the other side where it was safe. Yep. But it looked like it was outside the way we'd shot it. So it's just about being clever.
Yeah, you could always cheat things in stunts if you think things through and you understand film language. Well,
100% you can. You only have to look at some of those old films and people have frozen it on YouTube or whatever when it's clearly a bloke in a wig, when it's supposed to be a woman going down a hill and he's got a beard and stuff. But when you just don't notice this stuff because you're following the story. Mm. And that's what's important. And you mentioned there about VFX as well. And do bear in mind that a lot of the time you will have to take some wires out in post, or you might have to take something else out, or someone holding someone out in post. It's just part of it. As long as you plan that and it's part of your budget, then it'll work. You know, I love doing stunts. I love doing fight sequences. I love knowing we could get something new and fresh and exciting from it. And then there's the fear factor as well, is how can we do this? And it's just being brave. And that's something that, you know, David Leitch has done here and Kelly McCormick have done here with The Fall Guy. And it's about stunt men and women. And it's about that, the moment getting, you know, everyone's talking about why isn't there an Oscar? And awards for these.
Well, they're going to be talking after this one. That's for sure.
It's
like one of the main plot issues is making sure stunt people do get their rightful recognition.
And they should. And this film does exactly that. And it's a bit of a love letter to filmmaking as well. So go out there.
Oh, it is. Yeah. There's some great film references in there about just how sets run and the sort of the silliness of it all, which
first
is really
AD
funny
and stuff. Yeah, yeah. It's just fun. Mm. It's just silly but also true.
Traveling.
You're traveling. Yeah. I think that's worth seeing just for that. And you're all filmmakers pretty much who like this, or people who love film who are listening right now anyway. So, and these are the kind of movies I love to watch. You love to watch the behind the scenes of how movies get made in a movie, but they often don't make that much money. Hence why they don't often get made. But this one will.
But this one should. Yeah.
Yeah, do go support. So give a huge thank you to Kelly McCormick. If you can find her on the social medias, then do. And give her a big shout and say thank you so much for the podcast and her thoughts. And if you're lucky enough, like Kelly, to rise up and do well, it is your duty to
throw some Semtex against the elevator and dive out the exploding glass onto a crash mat.
And throw the dummy back down. We will see you next Tuesday when we have on No Way Up, Andrew Rogers.
Oh, Beard Rogers.
Yeah. Fantastic film with Claudio Farr, the director. They're joining us to talk about how they made their shark movie set on a plane underwater. It is brilliant. Thank you so much for listening. Yeah. It means a lot.
An unreasonable amount, really.
Yes, but we haven't had a really nice review for a while. Just get the shit ones. No, we have.
If only we'd get nice reviews.
No, we do, and we love you for it. But if you're feeling kind, please do go on your podcast player of choice and give it a nice review, and certainly press the plus button. That is how an independent podcast like this, which we do for free, makes us want to keep doing it.
Horribly free.
If you go in and can, by the way, I hope you're prepped. We do have a survival guide to can on our blog. Do go check that out. I might repost that as well. But until next Tuesday, Dom, take care.
You take care as well.
And you at home, or in the bath, or on the tube, or at work. We will see you next Tuesday. Lots of love.
Bye.